Hey everybody, it's Economics Matters. Larry Kotlikoff back with you. I've got my good friend and colleague Adam Gorin with me in my office here at Boston University. And I thought it'd be fun to talk about Adam's research in economics of housing and mortgages, which is he's worked in other parts of economics as well, but he's been specializing on these topics, and certainly a lot of people are having trouble buying homes these days. And also the mortgage rate is super high. So Adam, maybe you can give us a little bit of, you know, kind of current event discussion for a second, starting with, well, actually before you get into explaining why house prices are so high and why mortgage rates are so high, even that inflation's come down. And anything in general you want to say about the current housing market, tell us a bit about how you got into economics and, you know, where you were born and how much you weighed as a baby. Okay, let's start there.
I don't know that. So I was born and raised in Los Angeles, California. In high school, I was really into computer programming and computer science, and actually got some work with a really prominent computer scientist, Alan Kay, who won the Turing Award for basically inventing the personal computer, windowed interfaces, object-oriented programming,
wow,
and stuff like that.
That's wild.
He is a very brilliant man, and I was very lucky to work with him.
In high school.
Yeah. But I realized I kind of wanted to work on things that were a little bit more about people. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I had read The Worldly Philosophers by Heilbronner, and some of Paul Krugman's collected columns from the 90s, which are just really brilliant explanations of how the economy works. And took an economics class senior year of high school.
Where did you go to high school?
I went to Harvard Westlake School in Los Angeles.
Okay.
And then in college,
College is where?
College was Harvard University.
Okay.
Yes, I went to a school called Harvard for far too long, but
I'm not going to hold this against you.
But when I was there, I took Ed Glaser's mathy intermediate microeconomic theory class, which really opened my eyes. He used mathematical models to to answer questions about all sorts of real world phenomena, and found that fascinating. But I was also interested in journalism. I was the opinion page editor of the newspaper. And eventually realized I didn't want to blog for my whole life, and decided I'd go to
Harvard Crimson.
Yes.
Right?
And decided to go to grad school. I figured if I didn't like research, I could always go back to being an economics journalist, but liked research, and here I am at BU as your colleague.
Who did you study with at Harvard?
So Ed Glaser and the late Emmanuel Fahey were my advisors. I ended up moving into kind of empirical macro, using applied micro methods and micro data to think about macro questions. The first day of grad school was the day Lehman failed.
Oh, that's cool.
Yes, I still remember David Labson getting up at the front of the room and saying, "You picked a great day to come to grad school." If you'd told me I'd be working on housing when I was applying to grad school, I would have said, "Probably not. That's a little boring." But it turned out housing wrecked the world. It took me a while for me to get into macroeconomics, but I eventually found it. And what I realized was that the housing market had really great micro data, and people hadn't used that micro data to think about macro questions. So I started in that, and one thing led to another, and now I have a lot of housing macro sort of papers and research.
So let's talk about the macro housing picture right now, and then we'll go back to September 15th, 2008.
Yep.
Your first day of grad school. Lehman fails. It's all attributed to subprime mortgages. It's one of the 17 major financial institutional failures.
Yep.
In 2007, 2008. I guess mostly all in 2008.
So let's talk about COVID first.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is a very, very strange housing market. And I think there are a few factors at play. Basically, what's going on now is if you look at housing markets, the single best predictor of price changes is inventory levels. And so right now you have high interest rates, a number of other factors kind of pushing towards lower demand. But inventory levels are as low as they've ever been. And that's been keeping prices pretty strong. In fact, they grew quite a bit and kind of have stabilized quite high. And the reason why is there's just very few houses transacting. And the houses that are transacting with very, I would say, desperate or more people who need to buy urgent.
So when you say inventory is low, you're saying that the houses being supplied, brought to be, onto the market to be sold. Nobody's selling houses right now, is
Exactly.
basically what you're saying.
There's very few houses being sold. And so where do houses that are sold come from? They come from kind of two different places. The first is existing home sales. And existing home sales is at this point the story of two groups of homeowners who don't want to move. The first are people with mortgages who've locked in a low mortgage rate when the Federal Reserve pushed down mortgage rates as part of quantitative easing after the pandemic. A lot of people locked in a 2.853% mortgage. Mortgage rates are now, we can talk about why later, in the sevens. And if you were to move, your monthly payment for a house of the same price would go up 60, 70%. So people just don't want to move. Sometimes this is called the golden handcuff. So that's part of it. I think the other part of it is older Americans who don't have a large mortgage or in some cases own their houses outright don't want to move. They want to age in place. COVID made them and a lot of other people realize that they like space and they like outdoor space and they like their house. And they certainly don't want to go to a nursing home or something like that. And so people just, when prices rise, you would usually expect to see older people take advantage of higher prices and use that as a time to downsize. But because of the change in preferences, that just hasn't happened. At the same time, younger people also want more housing. They would like outdoor space. The millennial generation is coming into the point where they are having kids and want to buy homes. So there's just been this big demand for space and for housing.
So why don't construction contractors make up the difference? Why aren't they?
Well, construction is historically a small fraction of overall home sales. So I don't think it would make up the whole gap, but it's very difficult to just build a lot of houses quickly. In the pandemic, we had huge supply chain problems. You read stories about houses being built, but not having windows or garage doors and not being able to sell. That has largely been overcome. There's also a labor shortage, both of unskilled labor, as the labor market has been very, very strong, and it's not as appealing to be in construction. People, there's a kind of has bid up wages, but also in skilled labor. I think this is actually very important. We built too many homes in the early 2000s, and as the number of home sales fell off a cliff in 2006, 7, 8, and stayed low. People didn't move into the skilled building trades. There weren't as many electricians and plumbers and carpenters and HVAC technicians and welders and all of these skilled trades. And you can't just create them overnight. It takes many, many years of apprenticeship. And so even though the fundamentals are very strong in the construction sector, it's been hard to get people in. And what we've seen is that construction costs have actually skyrocketed as well. And so if you think about why are prices high, prices are also high because construction is really expensive. Where we are in Boston, for instance, construction costs are up almost 40% since the pandemic started and have kind of plateaued at that level. So overall, it's you know, people aren't selling, existing homeowners aren't selling, those with mortgages, those without mortgages. Construction remains strong, but despite high interest rates, but it just can't make up that gap. And so you see very, very few homes on the market, especially in highly desirable places. And that's kept house prices really elevated. Even though they're and demand pretty strong despite high interest rates, which usually would erode demand pretty quickly.
So is this like a national story, or is it mostly more New England and California? And if you go to, let's say, Iowa, can you find people that are building houses and at a reasonable price? And or obviously you can't necessarily take your job with you, but although there is more zooming to work, right?
So the early 2000s housing cycle was more of a coastal thing. This latest cycle has been a lot more widespread. I don't have a lot of expertise about Iowa, but look at Austin, Texas, where house prices are starting to fall a little bit after going through the roof. The Wall Street Journal recently had a story about how construction, house prices are finally coming down in Iowa as if it's a, in Austin, as if it's a bad thing. But from an affordability perspective and the fact that we need to supply more houses, I think it's a good thing. At some point, supply should catch up. And at that point, I'd imagine prices would come down. And hopefully at some point, inventory picks up and people start selling houses. And at that point, I'd expect house prices to come down somewhat. But I don't think they'll crash.
So here's another, you know, when I look around Boston, because we, you know, my wife and I lived here for about 8 years before we moved to Providence. And I lived in Lexington nearby for many, many decades. So I've been here since in the Boston area for like since 1973, a long time. Okay. 50 years, really. So, you know, I look around at what's being built. There's a lot of new construction. It's all apartment buildings, all located where the subway stops are. That's been the big, it seems to me, the big phenomenon of building in Boston. Everywhere there's a subway stop, you see, you know, 15, 20 sky high apartment complexes with retail, and it's all rental as opposed to, I think it's all rental. At least in Providence, they're just building rental units. So, and I asked a guy who was, ran into a person who was in charge, like the property manager of a brand new apartment complex. And I asked him, how come you are putting up rental units as opposed to condos that people can buy? He said, the companies don't, his company and other companies don't want to deal with the condo owners associations. They want to have complete control of the entire thing and not have to like half what, you know, start building things, start getting some money by selling some of the units, and now have a condo association that has wants to argue with them over what they're doing. And is that something you've heard before? Or let me ask you more fundamentally, is there any evidence that the new construction is disproportionately rental versus condo or housing?
Let's talk about retirement for a minute. It's something Americans think about regularly. Ask yourself, how financially secure do you really feel? Do you have enough money to retire? How much is really enough? And if you don't have enough money, how can you possibly find that extra money before you do retire? These are all tough questions. My retirement software, Maxify Planner, is the powerful online planning tool that takes the guesswork out of retirement. It weighs your assets against your fixed expenses to calculate how much you can safely spend every year for the rest of your life based on when you decide to retire. And it shows you safe ways to find more money. Maxify makes a complicated problem like retirement planning simple. It's accurate, easy to use, and produces what you really seek, peace of mind. So make the smart choice and visit Maxify.com today. Don't miss this opportunity. That's Maxify with an I, M-A-X-I-F-I, Maxify.com. Now let's get back to the podcast.
So I think in single family housing market is strong. In places like Boston and Providence, There are just not a lot of empty lots to build new single family homes.
But you're saying across the country, it's not.
Across the country, I think,
it's not dropped a lot.
We have seen a shift in the composition towards multifamily and rental. And I think that's because housing is so unaffordable and a lot of people can't make the down payment and have turned to renting. And I also think that to some extent, local politicians can incentivize and push for larger rental buildings. There have been this kind of transit-oriented zoning. We've seen that in Boston. We've seen that in California, where politicians are trying to zone more densely along transit lines, which I think makes a lot of sense. Local planning and development boards and zoning boards can have a lot more leverage over larger buildings that require special exemptions. And so they can kind of nudge developers in that direction. In places like Boston, even multifamily construction is really stalling. I was on a committee
construction of rental rentals. Okay.
So I was on this commission. Mayor Wu of Boston, who actually, when I talked about Ed Glazer's intermediate micro class, she took that class with me almost 20 years ago.
Wow.
And she stayed in touch with Ed Glazer. And last summer, she asked him to put together a committee of academics to study why we aren't building so many, why there's so many buildings that are multifamily buildings that are approved, but not yet being built in Boston. And asked us to think about property tax abatement policies. So I want to say I'm not speaking for my co-committee members. And I think it was to her credit to, ask for a real academic input on this. But we got some great data. And what we found is, imagine you're a developer and imagine you want to build, you're deciding whether you want to build a building. And you do a simple calculation that we call a cap rate calculation. Indeed, we went and we talked to people who teach development and essentially tried to replicate the calculation that a developer would make. So basically what you're trying to say is the return on the building, which is rent net of costs divided by construction costs above some hurdle rate, which is related to the return on other assets. Now, as interest rates have gone up, the return that you need has gone way up. At the same time, that ratio, which is, again, rent net of costs, divided by building costs, which includes construction costs, land acquisition costs, other development costs, think architecture, insurance, and financing costs. The dominant thing in that denominator is building costs. And as building costs, I talked about building costs going up 40% in Boston. That has really brought that denominator up and pulled that ratio of, essentially the return on the building down. At the same moment that interest rates have gone up. And that means that a lot of buildings that made sense to build before the pandemic are now way, way, way...
underwater
they just don't make sense to pursue it.
Builders have to borrow to finance.
They have to do that at higher rates. Yeah.
Yeah.
So all this means that we then looked at residential property tax abatement and found that it essentially couldn't do much because the residential property tax was 1% of the value and 1% of the assessed value could only really change that ratio by 1%. And with interest rates going up so much and construction costs going up so much, there was kind of these buildings were not within 1% of being profitable, most of them. But you can imagine what buildings are going forward. They tend to be special projects that are in particularly good locations, or cases where a developer wants to build something else and has gotten approval for that from the city by promising some residential component to it. So imagine you're building a lot of lab space, mm-hmm. and you say, I'm also going to build a residential building to make it more appealing to the city to approve it. If the lab space makes sense, you might use the residential component as, in some senses, a loss leader.
I see. So if you're a young person, you know, maybe listening to this, maybe you're 30, 35, you're thinking about how much it costs for you to rent. You've seen rents go up, I guess,
yeah,
during this period. How much of, you know, compared to going back, let's say 20 years, what's your somebody's annual spending is now going towards housing as opposed to, and we also know there's a lot of kids living at home, right, with their parents.
Yeah, so I don't,
much bigger share than
I don't
used to be the case, right?
Well, I think it's, I don't have the data on that off the top of my head. I wish I did.
No.
And I don't have the data. Look, it is expensive. It is expensive for a lot of people. And given the fundamentals of construction and just, you know, how much interest rates are up, how much construction costs are up, I don't see a ton of new of optimism on the horizon. In Boston, I would speculate that some of the increase in construction costs was due to the lab boom, which seems to have cooled. So maybe that might lead to construction costs coming down. That's not something nationwide, but, you know, we'd like to see a lot more supply coming on the market and construction. And we'd also like to see the market starting to move and inventory starting to pick up, which will happen gradually as people pay down their mortgages and rates come down. And,
yeah,
but it's going to be a gradual process, and I don't see a silver bullet to bring down construction costs and house prices. I do think that there are some levers that you can pull with zoning that would increase supply. So if you look at the YIMBY, Yes in My Backyard movement, a lot of efforts that are quite bipartisan to try to reform zoning codes, have a lot more density by right for builders, and really try to make it so that supply can come on the market. You also see some things for accessory dwelling units. So in California now, everybody can have an accessory dwelling unit, a second unit on their property. Kind of getting rid of single family zoning in that sense, and trying at least to allow for there to be some private development of additional units. I think all of these things are kind of a push in the right direction, but won't solve everything.
So, I mean, part of the background story here is that we have I don't know whether population projections are different now from then a couple of years. Last time I looked, we had a projected increase of about 80 to 90 million people by the end of the century. A huge population explosion in the country underway. Even though the country's aging, you still have a lot of people coming in through, you know, just natural fertility of American citizens, but also immigration is high. So, and there's only, you know, one Boston, right? And people seem to be, the middle of the country seems to be emptying out towards the coast. I don't know to what extent that's old news or still news, but there's only so many people that can live in the cities, but the cities are the places where the jobs are better paying. So it's...
There's a lot of... So certainly that was the case before COVID. There's been a lot of research on how COVID has changed that because of work from home and remote work. Some people have been telling that, you know, if you look at San Francisco, it has really emptied out in a way I think that has taken people aback. You've seen that less in other cities, but it's still happening. You still do see people moving to the Sun Belt and other places away from these cities. I think it's really, the jury's, I think, a little bit still out. You see stories of quote unquote the urban doom loop, which is essentially of all the offices going vacant, that brings down the tax base of the city. The city has to cut its budget and reduce amenities. And that kind of makes the city less appealing and leads to this kind of spiral. So people like Stenda Neuerberg and Arpit Gupta have been doing a lot of work on that story. I think the jury's still out as to how bad that will be, and whether there is a forthcoming, as they call it, commercial real estate apocalypse. But, you know, cities have historically been places of knowledge production and knowledge generation. And to some extent, they still are. But I think there's is a question about how remote work has changed that. And it's not something I'm an expert on, but I think it's an interesting question going forward.
Have you heard much about converting these empty office buildings? I think the national vacancy rate is around 20% of the office buildings. I think historically, 8-10% was the right was the number. So we have a lot of vacant office buildings, and a lot of you know, banks that are basically finance these S corporations, construction companies, who said, you know, we're this company and we're limited liability, and lend us money, and we're going to build this building. And they build it, and you know, they can't basically sell the units or whatever, rent the units. And then the bank is, then they go bankrupt and the bank takes over the building, and then the banks can go bankrupt. So there is a potential for going back to 2008, the kind of financial crisis that we saw.
So that's exactly what this research by the Neuberg and Gupta et al. Kind of looks at. And their argument is essentially that vacancy rates will continue to climb because a lot of these leases that people don't want anymore are long-term leases. And so it's going to be kind of a slow bleed in the commercial office space. And that'll really hurt bank balance sheets. I think it is certainly a big concern, and a big concern of people in the commercial real estate world. I don't pretend to be an expert on that. I'm more of a consumer of that research. But I think it is a major worry. As for conversions, again,
it's very difficult. Huh?
I'm not a
architect. Sorry.
I'm not an architect, but I have listened to a lot of podcasts and a lot of articles about this. I think what's interesting is the floor plates of a commercial versus a residential building are very, very different. In a residential building, every bedroom needs a window, an exterior window. And if you think about most modern office buildings, they don't have a lot of exterior windows. So the New York Times had a cool article about how in New York, they essentially drilled a courtyard down the middle of a building.
I see. Oh.
But that required a lot of retrofitting. So I think, you know, Van Nieuwenberg and Gupta, they have done some look inquiry into how many buildings are out there that could be converted based on their floor plates and other architectural features. It's not as many as you might hope, and it's expensive. So I don't think that's a panacea.
So if you, let's say you, you know, your rent maybe in Brooklyn and it's expensive, but you maybe rent a small place. So you give up space so you can be around your buddies group and have, you know, good high paying jobs, even though New York's expensive. But anyway, you have that experience. And then you say to yourself, I don't have the opportunity to invest in real estate like my parents did, because here I am 35, 40. I don't have a home that I'm paying off, which, you know, forced my parents to save. So they ended up at retirement with some equity in their house. So my response to that, I was wondering what yours is, but my response would be force yourself to save so much every week, but invest it in part in REITs, in real estate investment trusts, get into real estate in that manner that you're not really locked out of investing in real estate. Maybe you'll actually be more diversified if you do it this way, rather than having all your money in your own house, which then suffers a hurricane or whatever. Yeah. What do you think?
I'm not going to try to outthink Larry Kotlikoff in thinking about savings and overlapping generations and Social Security type questions.
Okay.
Over a decade at BU, I've learned to ask you about this stuff. But I certainly agree that one thing that was appealing about mortgages is that they did compel savings, and people like Labson and Madrian and their co-authors, in thinking about kind of behavioral stories about why people undersave and how it would be good for them to have a commitment device to save, they've turned to things like mortgages. So I think there is a question of, you know, maybe a really smart person would do what you were saying, but I think the worry is that for behavioral reasons, maybe people won't, and then.
Well, I'll say not smart, but just disciplined.
Yeah. I mean, again, yes. So I also think that there has been a tendency, at least in the last 40 years, to think of a home as an asset that will always appreciate faster than inflation. And that has been the case for a long while. But I don't think there's any guarantee that that will
I don't think
always be the case.
You know, if you look back from like 1950 till today, you don't see that housing has been a fantastic investment compared to like the stock market, for example. And then you have, you know, having we have a house that was built in 1720, and we thought when we got there it was in great shape, and so we just replaced the back window at a very high price because it had to be handmade because it's a 1720 house. It's 5 years after Louis XIV died, the oldest house in Providence, it seems. And when the front window was being rebuilt, and then we had a leak from the ceiling and the living room.
Certainly, like, I'm not saying that it's a better return than stocks, but I'm saying that, you know, a stock doesn't give you the same utility value that you get from living in your house.
House is like an annuity. I mean, you sit in there, you get these services that continue until you die, and it's a real annuity, and there's no real annuity.
I think you want to think of a house as a place to live, not as an investment.
Want more money, less risk, and a better life? Buy Money Magic, a new book by Lawrence Kotlikoff, Boston University economist, personal finance expert, and best-selling author. Whether it's education, career, marriage, housing, investing, retirement, Social Security, IRA, or 401k decisions, Money Magic delivers scores of secrets to raise your living standard. Financial journalist Jane Bryant Quinn says Money Magic is a must-read. Nobel laureate George Akerlof says Money Magic is quite probably the best financial advice book ever written. Financial guru John Malden says, you'll love this amazing book. It's full of wit, wisdom, and startling paths to a better financial life. And columnist Scott Burns calls Money Magic a funny, brilliant read, offering wildly powerful, unconventional choices that can literally change your life. Get Lawrence Kotlikoff's Money Magic today at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and independent booksellers.
You know, I agree with it. Let's go back to the 2008, because this is kind of a pet peeve I have about, you know, here we have this rate.
Do you want to talk about mortgage rates first? Or do you want
Let's talk about mortgage. Yeah. Tell me about mortgage rates.
So mortgage rates have gone up. And I think that's part of what's going, what's made this current period so painful for a lot of people. And there's two things going on. The first is that the Fed fighting inflation has increased the short rate, and that has had an impact on long rates. Typically, the mortgage, the 30-year mortgage, is priced off the 10-year treasury, and the 10-year treasury has gone up quite a bit. But on top of that, the spread between a conventional 30-year mortgage and a 10-year treasury has gone up quite dramatically as well. That's happened for a number of reasons. I think a lot of it has been prepayment risk. So what's the difference between buying a mortgage-backed security and buying a government bond? It's that the mortgage-backed security, the mortgage holders have a free option to prepay that loan whenever they want. And that changes the duration of that bond. And what happened is people are prepaying these mortgages very, very little. So when you bought an MBS on a mortgage-backed security on a 3% mortgage, I think people thought, oh yeah, well, people are going to prepay quite a bit. Maybe not at the same rate that they were before, but somewhat. People will have to move and will refinance for other reasons. Maybe they need cash or something. But And I don't think anybody expected inflation to go so high and interest rates to go up for that reason. And it turns out that prepayment fell just much more than most market participants anticipated. And that really burned them on mortgage-backed securities. And people, investors have really pulled back from mortgage-backed securities. And that's increased the spread on mortgages relative to 10-year bonds. There's also been some natural buyers of MBS kind of pulling back from the market. And all of this has led to these spreads between mortgage rates.
Why is this a bad deal for, you know, if I have I'm a bank, let's say, so I've got this, so I lend you money and you don't, you know, and you don't prepay. So isn't that in my favor because I get to charge you a high rate and you keep paying it because rates, let's say, haven't come down and you don't refinance. So isn't that why? And if somebody buys a bunch of my mortgages as part of their mortgage-backed security bundle of mortgages, isn't it a good thing that you don't repeat? You're saying it's a bad thing for me.
I'm saying that a lot of people got burned by MBS when there was suddenly inflation.
When inflation took off.
When inflation took off and people weren't moving and weren't prepaying their loans.
So because they're getting paid back in watered down dollars. So my mortgage I issued maybe at 3% to you, and now inflation's it was, you know, cumulatively it's gone up.
The price it's a little bit more subtle than that because the 10-year bond, the federal government would also be paying you back on watered down dollars.
Yeah.
But it's also that people just were hanging on to this mortgage for dear life. And instead of 8% of people selling their house or refinancing their mortgage and prepaying their mortgage each year, that's fallen to 2 or 3%.
So I'm stuck paying getting this income on a 2 or 3% mortgage forever because you realize that you get to pay back in $110.
Exactly.
And that's where I'm really getting nailed.
And so the thing that's different from the 10-year bond is that there's this like variable duration based on market conditions.
So I would say, you know, that there's a risk premium when you take out a mortgage at 6% these days. And I'm the bank, I'm charging you interest because just the time value of money, but I'm also charging you I'm in effect insuring you against inflation, because if inflation takes off, you might get hurt in some other way. Maybe your job, your salary doesn't go up, but you get to pay back the mortgage in watered down dollars. So I'm selling you like two things. I'm lending you money, but I'm also selling you inflation insurance. And the two are wrapped together in this 7% mortgage. Would you agree with that description?
So I agree with that description. I mean, mortgages are nominal. But again, treasury bonds have the same principle. They're also nominal. So what I'm trying to do in my head is split this into some of the argument that you just made about watered down dollars applies to a 10-year treasury bond. Yeah. And then in some ways, and the 10-year treasury bond has gone up, precisely for the reasons you described in part. But on top of that, the spread between the price of the mortgage rate relative to the 10-year treasury bond has also gone up. And that's because the mortgage has this duration risk. And I think people thought, oh, inflation is going to be low, so I don't really need to think about if inflation spikes, the duration of my loan is going to go up. Instead of being able to get the money back sooner and get a higher interest rate, I'm stuck holding on to this 3% coupon bond forever. And with the duration going up, I think that spooked people a little bit out of mortgages, and that's pushed up rates.
Okay.
So there's a lot. I mean, I'm not the expert on this, but there's been some great, if people are interested in this, I would highly suggest the Odd Lots podcast. Bloomberg Odd Lots had a great episode on this stuff, but
called Odd Lots. Is it?
Odd Lots. It's a Bloomberg podcast about markets and stuff that had some excellent guests talking about this.
Okay.
The spread. I think there's two things going on. There's inflation, but there's also this kind of duration risk in mortgages. And then, of course, there's also default risk in mortgages, which we'll talk about when we get to 2008. But that default risk is largely taken on by the government now because Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac hold on to that risk. That's what they're insuring.
Okay. So let's go. Yeah, let's go back to 2008. When you look at, you know, what the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission This was the commission that was set up after the Great Recession to investigate the causes of the Great Recession. It was like the parallel to the PCORA Commission that was set up after the Great Depression. It was set up in 33 or so after the things really got bad. So the FCIC, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, I read the report, every page. It's all about the housing market and how you had these kind of ninja, no doc, liar loans taking over the subprime market. The subprime market's taking over the entire mortgage market. You had all these companies investing in these crappy securities that were complex, and they were in these packages together in these derivatives that nobody understood, and they were sold to people in Norway who were trusting, you know, schools are invested in these things, and they sure. They went broke. That was the whole narrative, and that we had rating companies rating stuff that was really garbage as AAA, and we had government officials who were asleep at the wheel. But when I looked at the data, and I wrote a paper called the Big Con, which is on my website, kotlikoff.net. Anybody can go to articles at kotlikoff.net and read the Big Con. When I looked at data 10 years later at each of these different allegations, none of it held up. It wasn't that the banks got more leverage. Let me just say this one thing, which is that the subprime seemed to be too small relative to the mortgage market. The mortgage market was too small relative to the US financial market, and the US financial market was too small relative to the global market to bring the entire damn world down to its, you know.
I'm gonna agree with you a little bit and disagree with you a little bit.
Go ahead.
Where I'm gonna agree with you is that I think the stories about malicious behavior and subprime were a little bit overplayed. There is a series of three papers, one by Adelino Shoar Severino, one by Paul Willen and Chris Foote, and one by Yaramir Nozal and Stefania Albanese. And I think they make a pretty convincing point, which is that there was a broad-based credit expansion. It was not like it was subprime growing and other things weren't growing. Subprime was the extensive margin, if you will, where we were giving credit to new borrowers who hadn't gotten it before, but it was part and parcel of a broader credit expansion across the credit quality spectrum. And that there was just kind of an overexpansion and glut of credit. And the question becomes, why? And I think some of it was reductions in lending standards that were perhaps unwise, some of it was just bad expectations, both on the part of lenders and borrowers. There's this great chart in a paper by Paul Willen, Chris Foote, and Chris Girardi, which shows the expectations of various scenarios by MBS professionals at Lehman Brothers. And they had a meltdown scenario, which they put 5% probability on. And the meltdown scenario was -5% price appreciation for 3 years, and thereafter prices went back and started growing at 2% again. That was 5% probability. Of course, what actually came to pass was over the course of 6 years, house prices fell nationally by about 30 to 35%, and fell even more in some areas. So in Vegas and Phoenix, they were down 60, 70, 80%. So I think there was just, nobody really saw it come. There was just really, really diluted expectations.
So let me ask you this last question.
Credit had to do, you know, people were lending credit in part because of bad expectations. So there's kind of a chicken and the egg thing about, was it credit or was it expectations?
I'd like to talk to you about a really powerful financial planning tool to help you make smart retirement and other critical financial decisions. It's a tool that factors in all your financial data and shows you what you can sustainably spend every year for the rest of your life. That tool is my software company's Maxify Planner. It's incredibly powerful, it's accurate, and it's easy to use. Maxify takes the guesswork out of financial decisions at every stage of life. Its focus is on raising, de-risking, and sustaining your living standard. Maxify lets you run what-if scenarios to see how your finances will change in taking new jobs, buying a home, doing Roth conversions, retiring early, downsizing, investing more in the market, you name it. Knowing the impact of these decisions before you make them is the secret to making smarter decisions. And it's also the secret to what we all seek, which is financial peace of mind. So please visit Maxify.com today to start planning. That's Maxify with an I, M-A-X-I-F-I.com, Maxify.com. Now let's get back to the podcast.
But okay, but let me ask you this question, and I know we're not too much time. So, you know, economists see these things happen, and then they say, well, you know, let's look for something in the market that was different than it should have been, or maybe a little bit overboard, and that's it. As opposed to saying, as I'm saying in this paper, The Big Con, this just shows you that the market has multiple equilibria, that the market can panic, the economy can panic. And what we had here was a panic. There was very little substance underlying. And then we know, and you know, because you're one of the top macroeconomists around, that we have models of multiple equilibria, we have models of panic where the economy, where people get scared. I'm hiring your employees, your customers, sorry, my employees are your customers, your employees are my customers. I fire my employees because I think that you're firing your employees or my customers.
And I see where you're going.
End up with the whole thing melting down, which is something that Keynes talked about back in the 30s
and in the teens. I think we don't have enough time to have a full discussion of multiple equilibrium versus unique equilibrium, nor probably do the listeners care. I think some of what you're saying is true in that there was a panic. And certainly, you know, what did the Fed do in 2008? It followed Walter Badgett, the founding editor of The Economist's advice from his famous tract Lombard Street to lend freely against fundamentally sound collateral at high interest rates. Because they thought there were a lot of fire sales going on. And certainly, I think there were a lot of fire sales going on. But I think those fire sales were happening in part because mortgage-backed securities became the key asset in the economy in a way that was dangerous. So what we had in 2008 was, you know, think of your old-fashioned bank run. Where a bank is giving out deposits which are of short duration and lending out loans which are of long duration. We saw that with deposit insurance. What we had in the financial crisis was something similar, where banks were financing themselves with repurchase, repo, and commercial paper that was based on a safe asset, and that safe asset was housing, was mortgage-backed securities that were repackaged in the ways you described earlier. And what happened was suddenly, and this might be like a multiple equilibria situation, it might not, people didn't trust the value of the collateral. They said, we're holding onto mortgages. A lot of the mortgages are going bad. I don't have the time to do due diligence on an overnight loan on that collateral. So I'm just not going to extend it, or I'm going to charge really, really high rates. And that turned into what we call the shadow bank, where people basically pulled money out of these overnight loans between banks and other financial institutions, which were based on lending overnight loans against mortgage-backed security collateral.
We had banks running on banks. That's what happened.
But it was because of the quality of the collateral, people suddenly panicking about the quality.
That's where we differ. I don't think it was the quality. I think this opacity in the financial market is there all the time. And that's the core thing. And at any point in time, You can have a run today on, you know, based on these empty office buildings that we talked about earlier.
Certainly, but I think that
on a good chunk of the bank, the small and medium sized banks are the owners of these office buildings in effect, and you could have large depositors, uninsured depositors in these banks pull out their $7 trillion, and that's Yeah, 7 trillion out of 17 trillion deposits.
I don't disagree. Yeah. But Mian and Sufi, whose research I love, had a really interesting thought experiment, which was there was the same amount of stock market wealth destroyed in the dot-com bust as there was real estate wealth destroyed in 2006 to 2012. Why did one lead to a mild recession and one lead to the Great Recession? And the answer they come up with, and what I think is probably right, is that housing is special. It's on household balance sheets, is what they argued. But it also, mortgages were really important to bank balance sheets and the plumbing of the financial system. And what you're describing here is commercial real estate in a run and leading to things that's basically saying commercial loans are also really important to the plumbing of the financial system. We need to be worried about that. And I very much agree with that. I think, again, what I'm saying is there's some assets that are systemically important. And I think in the early 2000s boom and bust, what people weren't accounting for was the fact that mortgages and mortgage-backed securities and housing were linked to the health of the financial system in a way that other assets weren't. And when those loans started going to sour, people panicked, people didn't look into them, people just said, I want to get rid of my mortgages.
So I think you're coming around to my side.
We were in the same space.
Every 15 years since the founding of the country, we have on average had a financial crisis. It's now 15 years since the Great Recession. And there's always been something, there's always been some asset that was pointed to as the criminal here, as the culprit. My view is, if you look at the whole sequence, it's that we do have a financial system that's kind of built to fail. It's a trust-based financial banking system. And that if you go to an equity finance system, when you have, when things go down, people individually absorb it. And that's what happened when the stock market failed in the dot-com bubble. People absorbed it. And the financial system itself, which is running kind of the show, the economic show, doesn't collapse. That's the difference to me. But we'll have to discuss
it. I mean, when you talk about whether it's debt and equity, I tend to think it has to do with the fact that these were really important assets on both household and bank balance sheets.
Well,
but and most households, whereas most households, the richer households hold stocks in the
US. But if you have a house, okay, just one last thing.
But let's
one last comment.
Yeah.
You own a house and the house price falls. Well, it's true, but you still have the house. I mean, in physically terms,
And so it matters that it's a levered asset.
If it's levered, it's one thing. If it's equity owned, it's different. Thank you so much. This was fun.
This was fun. And we'll end on, I guess, that very gloomy note.
Well, we're economists, so we have to be somewhat dismal. Are you going to be upbeat you want to say something upbeat just to say goodbye? Is the housing market going to get better for people?
I will say something upbeat, which is some of my favorite research since 2008 has been really important work on how to modify mortgages and what the best way to do that is. And I think that research, in 2008, we were flying blind in some sense. We didn't know how to modify mortgages, and we did a really bad job of it, if you look in retrospect. And I think that if there is a real estate crisis in the future, we are going to be in a much better position in terms of understanding how to effectively modify mortgages because of recent economic research. So maybe that is a good news about economic research.
So you're saying that the government policy would be better formulated if there is another episode like we just saw in the Great Recession.
That is my hope. But you never know until you see it in action. So.
Okay. Well, this has been great.
Yep. Thanks,
so
Larry.
Much. Thanks, everybody. Another episode of Economics Matters. We'll be back soon with some more fun discussions of economics.